This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.
Perhaps you've been lucky enough to hear or see a kaka in the wider Dunedin area in the last few years. Is your garden ready for a kaka visit? Listen in to find out how we can live well with kaka, find out the benefits of big old trees, native or exotic, and why having a 1,000-year plan is a perfect timeline for successful rewilding. Today's episode of Rewilding in Action is supported by Bin In Dunedin at 126 Crawford Street. Locally owned and operated, Bin In Dunedin specialises in quality whole foods, speciality grocery items, and low-waste shopping options for Dunedinites. For more information, go to binin.co.nz. Kia ora, welcome to Rewilding in Action with me, your host, Maureen Howard. For this episode, I've come to Orakanui Eco Sanctuary, Te Korowai o Mihiwaka, that's about 20 kilometres northeast of Dunedin on the Blueskin Road. With 307 hectares of coastal Otago forest, it's the largest predator-free forest in the South Island, and it's got a 1,000-year vision for the recovery of native forest and its inhabitants. The predator-proof fence was erected in 2007, mammalian predators were eradicated, and kaka, Nestor meridionalis, were reintroduced in 2008. Kaka are our largest forest parrot. They're endemic and nationally vulnerable in the South Island. However, thanks in large part to Orakanui Eco Sanctuary, the tide is turning for this species, with sights of them occurring outside the fence and becoming more frequent in the last few years. I'm here to speak with communications and advocacy lead for the sanctuary, Taylor Davies Colley. With kaka on the way to returning to Dunedin, this seems like a good time to find out more about this species, the ecological roles it used to fill in the forest habitat, and what we can do to help it when it visits our garden. So join me outside the kaka aviary at Orakanui Eco Sanctuary. So far, there's Tui and Korimako jostling about at the sugar water feeder. And while we wait for some kaka to fly in, I ask Taylor about the purpose of the kaka aviary.
So it was built as part of the initial soft release efforts of these birds. So kaka can travel long distances. We know that some were tagged in Kirikiriroa, Hamilton, and ended up on Aotea, Great Barrier. So that's hundreds of kilometres. So the 10 kilometres back to Dunedin City from here would be nothing. And we know that because they travel there all the time. So by having an aviary that we can put them in for a little bit, it kind of centres them to Orakanui. And now it gives them also an opportunity for them to mix and mingle with our resident kaka. Just means they're more likely to stay and be settled into this population. And these soft releases are something we tend to do for lots of birds when we bring them in.
And how do they get integrated in with the resident kaka? Is there a bit of squabbling? What goes on?
There's always interest from our resident kaka when we have birds in the aviary. And that's not surprising because they are a really social species. And they're also really interested in new or interesting things. And for them, new kaka are interesting because they often come to Orakanui with language or dialect or even a little bit of the culture they bring from wherever they've come from. That does probably appear a little bit different to our resident kaka, who are kind of a relatively established kind of population now. And so it does take them a little bit of time to settle in, to change the way that they speak, I guess. They kind of make different noises when they arrive. And then after a while, they settle in and they start to make noises that sound much more similar to our local kaka. And so there probably is a little bit of learning the culture, settling in, and kind of understanding, I guess, the lay of the land. Yeah.
It's so amazing. It's so interesting, isn't it, to think of them having to learn the new dialect.
Yeah. And it is, I don't know how much of it maybe is it stuff they already know and are able to bring out, or is it stuff that they actually have to learn, you know? And I don't think we know that very well yet.
There's another research topic for somebody. Yeah, so they were breeding in here pretty fast, would you say?
Yeah, so One really neat thing about kaka is that they are very capable of living in these habitats. So once they were in the forest, once they were in this place, felt safe, they had the food they need, they had the habitat they need, they did breed in the sanctuary relatively quickly, which was exactly kind of what we expected, particularly older, more established birds. And, you know, we've had birds like a pair from Willowbank who spent 10 years in captivity, and then we released them into the sanctuary, and the first year they breed here in a tree cavity. So they are really clever, capable birds surviving in the wild, even ex-captive birds. And so, yeah, it's great that we can provide them a space where they feel safe and happy to get into it.
And so these big tree cavities, are they dead trees or are they still living trees?
Yeah, so kaka do require very big cavities to survive. And that is actually kind of a hindrance to the recovery, if anything, because we need really big old trees. We don't see those cavities form in young forest or small forest. And we're really lucky here at Orokonui that the centre of the valley is relatively original. And it's got some big things like kapoka, grizzlinia, which is the broadleaf, some big rimu and totara miro and those sorts of things that have cavities as well. But even so, we also put out nest boxes for them in the sanctuary to help support providing even more cavities. But these cavities can be sort of half metre wide and sometimes multiple metres long. And those are great places to raise chicks because they're nice and stable in temperature and they're a great little kind of sheltered spot from the weather. But the downside of that, of course, is apart from those cavities not being very common in our modern forests because they're younger, those cavities are also great places for a stoat, a rat, a cat, a possum, or anything like that to get in. And these birds are spending up to, you know, 3 months between an egg hatching and a chick fledging, and that just makes them so vulnerable. And so nests outside of protected areas like Orokonui don't have that high success, if any success, in older places.
Yeah, so you've mentioned a really key thing. It's the predators. I guess it's that combined with the loss of forest, isn't it, that led to their decline. They would have been everywhere here, wouldn't they?
Yeah, so kaka are forest obligates. To them, a paddock of grass might as well be the ocean or a desert, you know. And so for them in Dunedin, they would have been quite prolific at one point, you know. There are reports of sort of flocks of as many as 100 birds potentially. And so, you know, and that comes from stories of mana whenua who would have had a deep connection with kaka here as a very important bird, but also from early Pākehā settlers as well. But as Dunedin grew, and it grew faster than any other city in New Zealand at one point, you know, there would have been huge demand for timber for housing and timber for boats and land for agriculture. And that basically meant that all of the kaka's habitat would have been more or less wiped out. And where there was any habitat remaining, any place that kaka could still live, when introduced mammals came, when those rats, those stoats, those possums, those cats came along, you know, those remaining kaka just would not have had a chance. And so they would have been probably lost by the early 1900s, if not slightly earlier. And they've been lost from this area since, until 2008.
So it's kind of prior to our current memory. So we haven't grown up with kaka, have we?
No, we haven't. You know, a lot of people in Dunedin aren't used to them being around. And so much so that when we do have these kaka turn up in people's backyards, it's not often that they're even aware of what they are. We still get a lot of people going, hey, I've got this big bird in my backyard. What is it? And yeah, and that's so interesting because we're just not used to having these big kaka around, these big birds around. And it's not something in New Zealand that we're used to have big wildlife kind of in our backyards.
Yes. And so this kind of gets to one of the things that I'm really interested in for this podcast is how can we live well with kaka? Because the 1,000-year plan, which is what Orokonui Eco Sanctuary promotes, is that a lot of this wildlife is going to spread, isn't it, beyond the eco sanctuary, and how we can live well with it. It's a really interesting challenge and opportunity and privilege for us, isn't it?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. For us at Orokonui, there is no success in terms of a species like kaka without them living outside the fence. We are a big area, 307 hectares, but that's not very big when we're talking about hundreds of kaka. And so it's only when these birds are breeding regularly outside the fence, when they're spreading all through the city and when they're kind of, you know, common in people's backyards, that we will be able to take a breath in terms of their conservation. And that's when we'll know that success, I guess, has occurred. And that goal is a little bit beyond us. We can do whatever we want inside of the sanctuary, but unless we all start to think about our role in the community and the conservation of kaka, then we won't get there. And so there's lots of things we all can do. And, you know, we talked already about predators. Predators are a massive, massive issue for kaka. That 3 months on the nest makes them super vulnerable. They are going to be eaten by almost anything that gets in there. And what's even worse is that you have these adult females often getting eaten on the nest as well. A bird that might live for 40 years and produce chicks every year. So if she's getting eaten, that's a huge impact on your population that you have. When they fledge, they also spend a little bit of time being silly and hopping around on the ground, and that makes them incredibly vulnerable as well to a cat or a dog or anything that might want to have a go at them. And then also, they're native birds. Kaka will spend time foraging on the ground, and so if you have a cat and it's interested, it'll probably have a go. And that is a big worry for us, again, for these birds that have these huge lifespans but could be taken out very quickly. So, you know, backyard trapping, being a responsible pet owner, these are really, really important things that we can think about. And not just from a perspective of what's going on in our place, you know, on our properties, but from thinking about our backyards as potentially not just our backyards, but part of a wider ecosystem, you know, a whole community of backyard forest, if you will. And so, you know, even if we're doing a little bit of predator control in our place, it's going to be benefiting everyone else. And if we all did that here and there, we start to really have an impact. So predators and pets are a really big thing. Forest is another. You know, these are forest birds. And so protecting first, and then also thinking about planting our forests and our backyards is really important. So if you
and
do
big trees,
and that's why I say always protecting first. Yeah. You know, we can't plant a forest that's going to support kaka now. we can, but it won't support kaka for a long time. Mm-hmm. And so for them, a big tree is a big tree to some extent. And so, of course, it's always going to be the best thing for everyone if it's a native tree, because that's, you know, kaka love native trees. And if they're eating the fruit, they're not going to be spreading around introduced trees. But if it's a tree, you know, and so if you've got big trees on your property, protecting those big trees for the time being until that forest can come up underneath is really important. We've got macrocarpa in the sanctuary that we are just leaving because we know that by the time the other forest comes up, those macrocarpa will probably be at the end of their lifespan anyway, not least because the kaka are doing a great job at tearing them to pieces. But, you know, protecting these big trees is the first most important thing we can do. And then going, well, actually, what can we plant around them that's going to support kaka as soon as possible, but also into the future? Knowing that this aspiration that we have of these birds being, you know, so common that they're waking us up in the morning everywhere is not necessarily a single generational outcome. And so we have to know that the trees we plant are going to benefit our descendants. And we should be working on that goal of being a good ancestor. And so planting trees now, but also acknowledging, and this is always something for people's backyards, acknowledging that we don't have to be the part of the forest that has the, you know, the giant rimu. You know,
yes.
If you've got a little urban garden, you don't need to be planting a totara or a rimu because your garden might be the bit that has, you know, some nice harakeke, some flax flowers. You know, your garden might be the bit that has some small fruiting plants or berries that the birds come in and feed on. If you've got a big garden and you've got a space for a big tree, kei te pai, that's awesome. But we don't have to also all be the giant forest. Because again, coming back to that thing, our gardens and our gardens, they're just one piece of this wider urban ecosystem.
Yes, I really love that idea that we're part of this big mosaic.
That's right.
And it might be that we back onto a DCC-owned reserve or some other bigger bit of land that can provide maybe the nesting habitat for those birds.
Yeah.
So when you talked about the stripping of the trees, why would they have been doing that?
I mean, kaka are looking for food. They're very, very talented at finding it as well. Their beaks are both incredibly strong and sharp, but also incredibly nimble. They've got tongues to get in and drink nectar. And so they're eating invertebrates, they're eating sap, they're eating berries, they're eating leaves, they're eating nectar. You know, we've even found them at times opportunistically feeding on things like robin eggs. So they are really finding whatever food they can in the forest, which is great. But it also means that they will use those beaks to find food in destructive ways sometimes. And if we encourage that, it becomes worse. So around our feeding stations in the sanctuary, we're really careful with our placement of them. because we never want to put them somewhere where a kaka is not going to recognise things around them as food. Uh-huh. So, you know, we often have people go, oh, it would be great to have one outside the cafe so we could watch the birds. But then the cafe would become a visual source of food.
So are you indirectly saying here it's probably not a good idea to have a feeder in your garden to attract kaka?
Well, that's right. That's right. Like the trees around our feeding stations are often more destroyed than trees in the rest of the forest because those are places where these birds are congregating, being focused on food. And kaka, their closest relatives are kia. And so if we think about kia, right, for years we've trained kia to rip apart cars, not because they're cheeky, not because they're playing, but because we get out of our cars, we open the door, we feed them in a car park, and then we get back in our cars. And where do the kia rip up? They rip up the door seals. They're trying to open the door. If we do the same outside our houses, these kaka will treat our houses the same way the kia treat cars.
And they'll try to get into the house.
Yeah, the difference is, though, is cars are metal and houses are not. And in Dunedin, a lot of the houses really aren't. And so kaka will rip apart our houses. They will go, oh, well, there's food in there, like there's food in a tree. We need to start ripping them up. And we know this from up in Te Whanganui Atara, up in Wellington, where, you know, Zealandia has had great success with kaka spreading around the city. And the property damage, the property damage is occurring on people's houses and the neighbours' houses of people who are feeding.
Ah, so even if your neighbour's feeding them,
yep,
maybe have a little kind chat.
Absolutely, yeah. So, yeah, so we don't want people feeding them because it encourages these bad behaviours. It encourages these kaka to view houses as food, and that will mean that they will start to tear apart people's houses, which has negative impacts beyond the damage to our property, because sometimes our houses are made of things that we don't want kaka to eat, treated timbers. Sometimes our houses have lead nails and flashings on the roof, and we already have had kaka in our population die from lead poisoning, from ingesting lead off people's roofs and places like that. And we know this is a really big problem for kia. But beyond that, feeding also has another really big impact, and that's that pretty much anything that we feed kaka that isn't really well thought out food like what we have here at Sanctuary is going to be bad for them.
Because it's not nutritionally complete.
Well, it's not nutritionally complete, but also, if you think about your pantry and you open it up, what is in your pantry that was here before people arrived in Aotearoa? Nothing. You know, unless you've got some fish in there, everything we eat as people we've brought with us to New Zealand. So for kaka who have lived in these forests for tens of millions of years, it's all junk food to them. It's all stuff that they don't really have the means to digest without causing problems. So things like bread, it's just terrible for them. It's toxic, basically. They get nothing from it, and it's really just not good for them. Nuts, delicious to kaka, but it causes deformative diseases like bone disease in their chicks if they feed it to. So kaka, these kaka, they come and these eat these nuts and they're delicious to them, and they go, oh great, I've got chicks, I'll feed them to them, and those chicks will get deformities and die.
Wow.
And the kaka don't know it. So essentially, feeding them is not only going to cause them to damage our property, which is not what we want, but also can have some really harmful impacts. And that's not even considering disease that we can be spreading using feeders as well. So we would always say, you know, kaka are more than capable of finding enough food in most areas around Dunedin. And we just don't think there's a need to feed them in our backyards at this stage, yeah.
And I guess by feeding them, we're also taking them out of their natural functional role in the environment by feeding them artificially. Like in those big flocks of kaka that would have, but in the past when populations were really healthy, what kind of impact would you have said? Like, I guess, did they maybe move around from area to area?
Yeah, they would have been definitely moving around the forest. I mean, they would have been seed dispersers, maybe less so than kia reru because they probably just crunched a few seeds up. They would have been pollinators. You know, if you see them in the harakeka, they get that pollen all over their face. And they also would have been just disturbing the forest, you know, digging up rotten wood, creating cavities, you know, breaking up big logs on the ground to help them decompose, and probably causing some level of disturbance in the forest. And that isn't always a bad thing. Forests aren't temporally stable. They're not stable in time. And so by kind of stirring up a tree, that may be promoting habitat for other birds, other animals, or other plants to have their time in the sun as well.
Hmm. It's really interesting. And in a way, we're sort of speculating, aren't we, to a certain extent. Our bird numbers are so degraded, we don't really have a true picture of what a really healthy, functioning forest was operating like.
That is a really good point, in that we don't really know a lot of times. And what's really nice about places like sanctuaries and protected islands and those sorts of things is we start to get an idea of what our wildlife is really like. And so much of what we know from our wildlife is them being pushed to the brink. And, you know, a lot of our lizards are like this. You know, we rediscovered them in these little rock piles, and so we think of them as living in these rock piles. And then you release that predator pressure and they live all over the trees.
Right.
Okay. And you know, up in Wellington, again, they've got these huge flocks of tui that people see in these kawhai trees, you know, like, you know, 50 or so tui. And, you know, you go, oh, I didn't know tui were a flocking bird. Here at Orokonui, we get a flock of 30 or so kereru. And you go, oh, of course, they're a pigeon. No wonder they flock, you know. But in the city, we only see them in sort of twos or threes. And so we do get this opportunity to see wildlife doing its thing. You know, wildlife being wild under these conditions that they're meant to live under.
Yes, it's that shifting baseline syndrome that we've all heard of, where each generation doesn't remember what the generation before experienced. And with each generation, we seem to having this declining of wildlife. But I hope that Orokonui Eco Sanctuary is part of the reversal of that, isn't it?
Yeah, I think we live in a really interesting time in that respect, in that certainly there's no sugarcoating that some of our wildlife is still declining. And there is a huge amount of work to be done for some of our species, or else we will lose them. But in some places and with some species, we live in a very exciting time where things are going in the right direction. And, you know, there are people who will have lived in Dunedin who, as young children, probably used to have lots of native birds around. And then those native birds probably declined to a point where they were almost gone. And now their numbers are coming back up. And that is phenomenal. There are kids who live in places like Dunedin now who will only ever have known what we have now, which is these, you know, that tui and korimako and kereru are relatively common in the city. And that's fantastic.
The new normal for them is a more enriched environment.
That's right. And so for them, you know, they don't even knew any different. And that is kind of funny in some ways, because a great example of that is kids that come to Orokonui now, they go, oh, more kaka, more taka here? We've seen these already. And you go, oh my gosh, and they're with their grandparents sometimes, and their grandparents remember when takahe was still thought to be extinct, you know?
Yeah, wow, it's amazing. Now, Orokonui Eco Sanctuary has a 1,000-year vision. Why did you choose such a vision?
I mean, there's lots of reasons for that. One is that our species are slow. Our forests are slow. For some of what we're trying to achieve here in our forest, it will be hundreds and hundreds of years before the tiny myrtle, which are just germinating now, are big trees that might have a cavity for a kaka. To a tara here at Orokonui, they're going to take thousands of years before the whole sanctuary is full of them, because they breed so slowly. But also it gives us time to think things over in the appropriate way, in that what we're doing now is not going to be for us. It's going to be for the future generations. And we can kind of relax in some ways. Not relax isn't the right word. We can kind of know that because we aren't trying to rush, that wherever we leave it and the work we've done will be a good place for the next person to take over. And that's really important when you're working in these native landscapes, because, you know, we have to think about what's going to happen in the future. And also gives us that opportunity with some of our introduced species, like these macrocarpa. Do we need to chop them down now? Because if we were trying to make Orokonui at this pristine native landscape in our lifetime, we would. If we're trying to, you know, have this aspiration of Orokonui being this incredibly thriving ecosystem in 1,000 years' time, the lifespan of these exotic trees and the role they're playing now is going to be important at the moment. But by the time we get to that next stage, you know, they will have done what they needed to do.
I absolutely love this. And Taylor, you know, I think that all of us should be starting to think in this much, much longer timescale, shouldn't we? And we might make wiser decisions at each step of the way.
Absolutely. I think, and I think with when we're talking about supporting our native wildlife, it's really the only way to think, that the decisions we make, things that will impact our future generations. Because whatever we do, you know, whether it's return a species to Otokonui, we're not returning it to Otokonui, we're returning it to this landscape. And that means that it will hopefully be around for our current generations, but also those future generations to come. And hopefully for them, their baseline is that they visit Otokonui and they're already sick of kaka by that point.
Thanks very much to my guest, Taylor Davies Colley, for sharing his passion about kaka and for how we can live well with them when they someday visit our garden. And when seen together, a mosaic of urban gardens with all these attributes can provide good habitat for kaka. I also love Otokonui Eco Sanctuary's 1,000-year plan. Rewilding makes so much more sense when we're able to think long-term. For example, we can be more patient and allow ecological succession processes to happen over the longer term. And in the interim, we can see the ecological benefits of exotic species such as large Macrocarpa. So thanks for listening to Rewilding in Action. I'm Maureen Howard. If you've enjoyed this episode, please remember to like it and to share it. It really helps hugely to get it heard by others. In my next episode, I'm talking about land covenants with Kathy Rufo, who's QE2's regional representative for Coastal Otago North. This is another of those must-listen-to episodes if you've got land that you want to rewild. Until next time, courtesy of Janina Castro, I will leave you with the wonderful sounds of kaka from Otokonui Eco Sanctuary, our much-loved forest parrot that is treasured by my guest, Taylor Davies Colley, a rewilder who is letting nature take the lead.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.